he heard himself say. "Yes, permafrost," said Ilona, "starting at about 1 meter below the surface." Monique shook her head. "The water is frozen, not liquid. That makes it difficult to use for biological reactions." "The soil is loaded with superoxides as well," Ilona added. "Living cells cannot exist in such a corrosive environment." "Terrestrial living cells," Jamie said. "This is Mars." Ilona smiled thinly. "I can't imagine any kind of living cells existing in a pit of rusty iron." "Anaerobic bacteria do so on Earth," Monique said. "Without access to water?"
"Ah, yes. There is that."
Jamie looked into Joanna's eyes. He saw more than fatigue there. She looked defeated, like a woman who had hacked her way through a jungle, only to find that she had gone in a circle and was back where she had started. "Well, it was just our first shot out there," he said. "None of us expected to find even copper, did we?" Monique brightened.
"There must be organic material somewhere in this soil. After all, the unmanned probes brought back rocks that bore organics."
"The surface has been bombarded by meteorites for eons," said Ilona, as if trying to convince herself. "Some of those meteorites had to be carbonaceous chondrites." Nodding, Jamie agreed. "Maybe the impact sites of chondritic meteorites are centers where life processes began."
"If the organics in the meteorite are not destroyed by the heat of the impact," Joanna nearly whispered.
"Yes, they might be, mightn't they?"
"We must make impact sites a new priority on our list of objectives," Monique said.
Ilona turned thoughtful.
"If life processes began at such impact sites, they would have spread across the entire surface of the planet, wouldn't they? After all, life is a dynamic process. It doesn't stay in one place. It expands. It grows. Only if it can find the nutrients and energy it requires," said Monique.
Otherwise, it dies out," Joanna said in a low, drained voice.
"Or it never even begins."
Jamie and the others fell silent.
"Even if meteorites bearing amino acids and other long-chain carbon molecules have been raining out of the sky for eons,"
Joanna went on, her voice so low he could barely hear her,
"what do they encounter when they reach the surface? High levels of ultraviolet and even harder radiation. Sub-freezing temperatures every night. The soil loaded with superoxides. No liquid water."
Jamie stopped her with an upraised hand. "Wait a minute. Even a small meteorite, like the one we found in Antarctica, would hit the ground with enough energy to liquefy the permafrost, if the ice is only a meter or so beneath the surface."
"Yes," said Ilona. "But how long would the water remain liquid?" "You saw what happened out there today," Monique said. "In this thin atmosphere, the water boils away instantly."
Jamie nodded reluctant agreement.
"There is no life on Mars," Joanna said. "None at all." "You're tired," said Monique. "We all are. A good night's sleep is what we need. Things will look better in the morning's light."
"Yes, Mama," said Ilona, grinning.
"But first, let us put a little water on our ceilings, eh?" Monique said. "Then we can sleep."
Joanna tried to smile at her, but did not quite make it. Jamie realized that she had wanted to be able to tell her father that they had discovered life. No one else mattered to Joanna, only her father. She wanted to give him that triumph. Now she felt that she had failed. He wanted to put his arm around her shoulders and tell her that it was all right, that if she hadn't made the great discovery, there were still important and wonderful things to be done on Mars. Even if the planet were totally dead, that information in itself could teach science vital knowledge about the needs and drives of life. He realized that he wanted to hold her, comfort her, lend her some of his own strength. But Joanna had no room in her life for him. Her father owned her soul. Everything she did for her father. Jamie felt a smoldering jealousy for a rival who was 100 million kilometers away, a rival he could not possibly fight. Washington, the White House. In bygone years, the map room had been used by Franklin D. Roosevelt as a situation room where he could follow the course of World War II. located on the ground floor of the mansion's central section, it was easy to get to from the Oval Office, even in a wheelchair. Now the president used the room for his weekly private lunches with the vice president, a tradition neither of them cherished. The first Hispanic to serve as president and the first woman to be vice president, the duo had inherited from the previous administration a Mars program that they would have canceled, except that it had gone too far to stop. Instead, they worked to win for themselves the credit for the first human landings on Mars, while cutting expenditures for the program back to the bone. As political cynicism goes, theirs was almost trivial. They made an odd-looking couple. The president was rotund and bald, with a dark mustache and large, soft brown eyes. His skin was not so dark as to frighten non-Hispanic voters. On television, he looked like a friendly, smiling uncle, or perhaps the easygoing guy who ran the hardware store. The vice president was wiry, ash-blonde, and strident. When she raised her voice, it took on the urgency of a dentist's drill. She was incensed.
"Do you realize how this looks to the media?" she asked, waving a gold salad fork in the air.
The president glanced past her irate face to the portrait of Franklin Pierce hanging against the cream-colored far wall, the least remembered of all the men who had lived in the White House. The president cherished Pierce's portrait. It served as a reminder and a spur. "At least I can do better than he did."
"You're not even listening to me."
The president returned his attention to his feet. She had never entirely outgrown her origins as a public school teacher in New Jersey. She was quick to anger, slow to forgive. "I understand the situation," he said softly. "All sorts of people have been hounding me about this Native American business, too."
"Well, what are we going to do about it? If we let the media have that videotape interview, he'll look like a goddamned saint. If we refuse to release it to the media, we'll look like bastards."
The president winced at her choice of words. He was, essentially, a gentleman. He felt relaxed among the luxurious burgundy draperies and lustrous Chippendale furnishings of the map room. Even the huge Persian carpet soothed him with its glowing colors and intricate geometric designs. "I saw the video," he answered. "The young man simply said he wasn't involved in politics. I don't see how that can hurt us."
"He's become a hero to the Indians," the vice president snapped. "And if we release that tape, he'll become a hero to every minority group in the nation."
"But those are our own people."
"Yes, right, our people. But if we let the media turn him into a hero, how long do you think it'll take Masterson and those other bastards to turn him into a front man for their own organization?"
The president shook his head. "I don't think so."
"Sure. You're retiring after next year. I've got to face all the primaries. It's tough enough being a woman without having to deal with a Native American who's been to Mars."
"But he's not interested in politics," said the president.
"Then why did he start that Indian crap?"
The vice president was fuming, her lunch lying before her untouched.
"He'll be getting back from Mars just in time for the first primaries. I don't want him being used against me."
The president, who understood something of politics, thought swiftly. "Suppose he becomes one of your supporters?" She shook her head doggedly.
"Masterson's in tight with the high-tech crowd. He'll grab his redskin before weekend, you know that. Remember, I was the one who got the Space Council to vote against funding for further Mars missions until we get the results back from this one. Masterson will crucify me for that. And this Indian will help him. He's already helping him."
Pushing his chair back slightly, the president gazed around the room for support. None of the portraits offered a bit of help, not even the one of FDR in his Navy cape. "Well, what can we do about it?" he asked.
"Muzzle him," the vice president replied immediately. "Get him off the team on the ground there on Mars and put him up in one of the orbiting ships. That way he'll be ignored by the media. They're only interested in what's going on the ground."
"But won't people think that we're hurting the scientists for political reasons?"
"We can find a reason to get him off the ground team. Not right away, of course. In a week or two. That will be plenty of time. The media might squawk, but I'd rather have them squawking now than a year from now when he gets back here."
"Do you think we can get away with that?"
"A year from now, he'll be forgotten. Nobody's got an attention span that long."
The president smiled gently. "You do." His vice president grimaced back at him.
"In our business, you need a long memory. And claws."
"And the video?"
"Tell the media he refused to be interviewed. Make him look like a stuck-up scientific type instead of a noble Indian trying to call attention to his people's plight."
The president nodded slowly. "It might work. and this power-hungry woman sitting across from him might just make herself